The Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Coming up on this week's Environment Show, factory pig farms are tough on the environment in the Midwest. Dam building in Southeast Asia threatens environmental disaster, but the World Bank is trying to stop the damage. Our ear to the ground meets a group in Colorado that fights to keep the range free of the home. And in California, male tarantulas are looking for sex, but it may be lethal. These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. Agriculture is changing in America. Small hog farms that once produced several hundred animals for local consumption are disappearing. And now they're being replaced by massive corporate-owned facilities that produce tens of thousands of hogs that are slaughtered for nationwide distribution. This change has created a real dilemma, and that is how to deal with the massive amounts of waste which the factory farms produce.
The Missouri Attorney General has launched an investigation into the waste discharge practices of Kansas City-based Premium Standard Farms, the nation's third-largest pork producer. Scott Holste is a spokesman for the Missouri Attorney General's office. He says the alleged spills at Premium Standard Farms are just one part of the investigation.
Number two, the construction of several of the facilities were not done in accordance with plans that were approved by the Department of Natural Resources. They did have plans that were approved by the department, but the actual construction of those plans did not follow through on those on what was approved. And number three, there's an issue of air emissions as well too. Speaking specifically of things that come in connection with spraying operations during the land application of some of the animal waste. In some instances, some of the application has been over applied, and there's a heavy concentration of nitrogen in the soil.
Holste says the goals of the investigation are to seek monetary relief in the forms of penalties and court orders if it is found premium standard facilities were not in compliance with current laws. The case was referred to the Attorney General's office by Missouri's Department of Natural Resources. Premium Standard Farms owns three large hog farms in northern Missouri with a total number of 80,000 hogs. And with each hog producing 6 to 8 gallons of waste a day, the amount of waste produced is enormous. Charlie Arnott is vice president of communications for Premium Standard. He says the company processes the waste by what he calls a sustainable environmental management system.
Every 2 hours, the waste is flushed from the barns into a storage lagoon where it is treated through anaerobic digestion. We test the nutrients in those lagoons 3 times each year to measure nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus. We test the soil that we apply the waste to twice a year before the spreading season and afterwards to determine the nutrients that are in the soil and what can be applied and absorbed by the plant filter base.
Arnott says the treated waste is used for fertilizer on crops grown by the company. These crops are then used to feed the hogs. He admits the swine production industry has had problems in the last couple of years. In fact, Premium Standard has been fined by the Missouri Department of Natural Resources for past violations. Arnott says with such a large volume of waste, companies in the meat production industry must take full responsibility when it comes to protecting the environment and area residents. Ralph Summers agrees. He is a coordinator for the Environmental Protection Agency's wastewater discharge program for the northern Missouri area. Summers says it is crucial that such large facilities are monitored closely. He says wastewater spills can be detrimental to aquatic species as well as humans.
The fish kills can happen from basically two sources. One is the amount of ammonia in the swine manure that might get away might be acutely toxic to the aquatic life, including the fish in the stream. And also biochemical oxygen demand in the stream, the organic matter may take away the oxygen and there be no oxygen there for the fish to consume, but usually it's the acutely toxic ammonia that will probably get the fish right away.
Summers says companies like Premium Standard must be permitted in order to process the waste. The permitting process is a result of the Clean Water Act of 1972 and enforced by the EPA. 42 out of the 50 states enforce the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System through their own agencies. In Missouri, it's the Department of Natural Resources. David Shore is the department's director. He admits the rapid expansion of meat production farms in Missouri has put a strain on his department, forcing the hiring of additional inspectors to monitor waste disposal practices.
We have had to increase our efforts overall to make sure that they land apply their waste material properly and keep it within the guidelines that we have set. The production facilities here are huge, and to give your listeners some scale, our largest operation in North Missouri has the equivalent flow in terms of waste as the city of St. Louis. So these are not small operations.
Shore admits that poor design and construction of meat production farms created environmental problems in the past. He says tougher laws and regulations are making positive changes in the industry, but says there are still waste and waste disposal issues that need to be addressed.
I think the area that we really have the greatest, has the greatest degree of suspect is the whole issue of application rates and how long can the land system produce the kind of water quality that we want, and that's where we're targeting our research dollars. The other issue in Missouri that has been very dramatic is odor. Odor in our state, we do not regulate.
Shore says Missouri residents and others living near large corporate-owned farms should be concerned with the environmental effects such facilities have. He says the country is going through a transitional period from small meat production farms to large corporate-owned facilities that present a challenge not only to the environment, but to the socioeconomics of rural agricultural communities. Shore says the demand for meat products has made it necessary for massive meat production sites. The challenge now is to make the transition as smooth as possible and protect the environment in the process. I'm Stephen Westcott for The Environment Show.
Situated between Vietnam and Thailand is the mountainous country of Laos. The steep Annamite mountain chain runs down its eastern flank, and that's also the location of the Ho Chi Minh Trail, where the Viet Minh hauled tons of supplies on their backs from North Vietnam to support the war in the south. Rivers flow out of the mountains into the mighty Mekong River, which forms the boundary between Laos and Thailand. The Thai economy has grown substantially in recent years, and as a result, so has its demand for electricity. As a result, the government of Laos is now building a lot of hydro dams to meet that demand. Lee Talbot, Senior Professor of Environment, International Affairs, and Public Policy at George Mason University, joins us again to talk about his second trip to inspect the Nam Tung 2 Dam, which is under construction. He's part of a three-person international team evaluating the environmental and social aspects of the project for the World Bank. The bank is guaranteeing the financing for the project. I asked him if he is still comfortable with his support for the dam, which is based on the plan to protect 4,000 square kilometers of the largest forest in Laos, which is situated upstream.
Yes, in fact, I'm even more comfortable now than I was before, for several reasons. This time, I arranged for us to visit several other dams, actually five separate dam sites, that have either been constructed or are in process of being constructed elsewhere in Laos, so that we could get a comparison, get an idea of how these things are being handled, where the World Bank has no role in it whatsoever. And I guess in briefest summary, our view of these five were that from an environmental and social point of view, they're essentially disasters. For example, one of them is cutting off the water from about a 50-kilometer stretch of river on which there are 20 villages who rely on the water for all the things you need water for, including fish for food. And the resettlement efforts, such as they are, we felt left a very great deal to be desired. The basic lesson from this is that if the process of ineffective dam construction is left to take its course without the regulations and procedures requirements of the World Bank, the results will be pretty disastrous from an environmental and a human point of view.
Talbot says since the dam is being put up by a private consortium, it will go ahead even if the World Bank does not guarantee the financing. He says the bank requirements provide the best hope for the indigenous people who will be flooded out.
The consortium, this is a private group from four countries, has committed to paying at least $1 million a year for 30 years, specifically to the conservation and management of this area. They have also developed a resettlement plan for the roughly 4,000 people who are going to be currently living in the inundation area, and they've already put in experimental farms and so forth in the resettlement areas, and we are extremely impressed with the thoroughness of the job they've done, and the the combination of that and the fact that a remarkable number of the people involved clearly want a better life. They want to move away from the extremely poor conditions in which they're now living.
Another unique aspect of the project, which has been brought about by World Bank requirements, is that for the first time, local people have been involved in planning to deal with the consequences.
Prior to this project, the basically socialist government of the People's Republic was not known for public participation and encouraging public participation in government decisions. Because of the bank requirements, they have had, I think, something like 8 separate public fora now, big ones, where the local people were involved, as well as the growing NGO community there. And I was in on one of the early ones and was impressed by how tentative everything was, because people weren't quite sure that the government was going to look kindly upon them. The situation has now gotten remarkably open, and the Lao authorities themselves are saying that they're finding this a very helpful thing. Well, if this is a successful project, this kind of open participation, we believe, is likely to continue.
The choice is not between a dam or no dam, because Nam Thong 2 will be built anyway. Talbot says that with increasing private sector sponsoring of large development projects, the Nam Thong 2 project shows that World Bank participation and its requirement for environmental and social safeguards are its only hope for success.
The panel, in its report on this trip, said that the panel places on record its considered and unanimous opinion that the Nam Thong 2 project should be undertaken with the participation of the World Bank. Now, as far as we know, this is the first time in history that such a panel has ever come out that way, with an unequivocal statement. And I should also emphasize that nobody on the panel is a lover of big dams.
Lee Talbot, Senior Professor of Environmental Science, International Affairs and Public Policy at George Mason University, is just back from an inspection trip to Laos as an environmental advisor to the World Bank. I'm Peter Burley, and we want to hear from you. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Our email address is green@wamc.org. You can listen to us anytime over the Internet. Go to our webpage. It's www.enn.com/envshow.
I'm Linda Anderson, and this is Ear to the Ground, with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, conserving Colorado's diminishing open lands. If you drive along Perry Park and Aulis Ranch roads during haying season, you might follow the progress of mowing, baling, and stacking. 30 miles south of Denver, the original Aulis and Pine Cliff ranches are spectacular historic properties. Rich in agriculture and ranching tradition, home to extensive wildlife, these ranches, along with 25,000 other Colorado acres, are protected by Colorado Open Lands, a nonprofit land trust. Begun in 1981, Colorado Open Lands, the second largest land trust in the state, aims to preserve land that is currently open, not developed, and keep it open forever. This, explains COL's Elizabeth Richardson, is done in a variety of ways, depending on who the landowner is and what the ultimate disposition of the land will be. Will it be kept in private ownership, or will some portion go to a government agency?
For example, it's called a conservation easement. It's where a landowner voluntarily restricts the surface use of the property to keep it as open space or keep it in agriculture or keep it as wildlife habitat forever. Another is through the use of what we call preservation or limited developments, where a portion of the land may have some houses put on it, but the rest of it is kept open. And then there are other methods where you're just working with a government somewhere along the line to see if there isn't possibility for preserving open space as part of their open space system.
For protection from future developers, the Aulis Ranch Preserve combined open space preservation with limited residential development. 96% of the ranch will be forever protected as open space, while 10 homesteads will share stewardship of the land. Richardson says COL has a lot of ranches in its program because, she adds, if you want to keep open space in Colorado, you have to find a way to make agriculture, specifically ranching, a viable industry.
We've got a lot of what we call centennial ranches, ranches that have been in the same family for 100 years. And we don't want the estate tax laws of the to force those to be sold just simply so you can pay the estate taxes. So these are families who very, very much want to see their land continue in ranching.
But ranches aren't all that COL acquires. Richardson says the COL takes a broad view of their mission, a view that reflects a wide diversity of people and interests. What's defined as open space, she says, can really vary.
In some cases, open space can be viewed as a place where you only go with your field glasses at some times of the year because you're watching baby eagles fledge, for example. But in other cases, some people view open space as a golf course.
Richardson says all easements are charitable donations made by the landowner. Whether their motivation is to protect elk habitat or reduce taxes, whether they are private or public entities, planners from the organization, she explains, help create the proper easement plan. Richardson says Colorado will continue to grow and attract new residents. That's why, she says, Colorado Open Lands is doing something now to preserve the future quality of life in Colorado. With Ear to the Ground, I'm Linda Anderson.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. Right now, it's mating season for the tarantula in Northern California, and the males are out looking for love. Mount Diablo, which is located about 30 miles east of San Francisco, is currently being overrun by the large hairy spiders. Jennifer Kaiser is Communications Director for Lindsay Wildlife Museum, and that's a rehabilitation center for wild animals in Walnut Creek, California. She describes the mating ritual as a large singles dance for lonely spiders.
What happens with tarantulas is that they're typically solitary, but they build their burrows fairly near each other, but they don't live in a big nest or anything. They each have their own small burrow in a larger space where they congregate. And the females have the babies, and the babies stay underground in the burrows for really, you know, anywhere from 6 or 7 up to 12 years. And when the males mature, they come out of their burrows, and that's pretty much their last gasp, as it were. They live underground, they eat smaller insects and grubs and things like that. Then the males come out of the burrows and begin looking for a female. And that's sort of where the trouble starts, really, for the males.
Kaiser says that as the male tarantulas search eagerly for mates, they often find themselves in people's backyards. This makes the folks nervous. However, Kaiser says that the locals have no fear, because the male tarantulas are looking for a mate only, and they don't want to eat anybody. Actually, it's the female tarantula that becomes the aggressor.
The females sit at the opening to the burrow, and the male cruises by, and sometimes there's no contact, but if he checks her out fairly closely and she doesn't like him, sometimes she kills him. If she does like him and allows him to mate with her, that maybe takes about a minute. She often kills him then, too, and eats him, actually. That's sort of her first meal after mating. If it's a really unsuccessful male who hasn't been killed either of those ways, they're only going to last maybe from a few weeks to a few months at the most once they go out on top. They'll never overwinter after that first season out of the burrow. So they live most of their lives without mating inside the burrows. They go out for this one mate.
Kaiser says the males are killed by the female venom, which she also uses to kill insects. But male tarantulas will do what they can to protect themselves from their angry mates.
The males have actually hold the female's fangs. They're mating face-to-face, as it were, standing on their rear legs. And the males are actually holding the female's fangs away from them during the mate. And the mate, the way the mate happens is the it looks like, if you're looking at a male tarantula, it looks like he has two short front legs. Those aren't actual legs. They're actually the ends of them are actually the where the sperm sacs are. And so he injects those into her, and then she tries to bite him immediately. Apparently, it's not a terribly romantic situation. Apparently, it's not a real pleasurable situation for the female, and so she immediately tries to bite him, and so he tries to hold her off, but often fails.
In addition, Kaiser says male tarantulas will try to jump quickly away to avoid getting killed following the mating process. Female tarantulas mate several times a year and can live to the age of 20 or 25. She adds that tarantulas have received bad press and says they're not aggressive animals. The animals will only attack if they feel threatened. A tarantula bite is equivalent to a bee sting, not lethal to most of us, but deadly if you're a male tarantula. So when it comes to sex, if you're a male tarantula, you're going to live longer if you just say no. Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. This is the Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, the battle against purple loosestrife. The plant is crowding out vegetation and destroying wildlife habitat. We have a report from upstate New York about a program using bugs to control it. We talk green about the new international convention to control nuclear waste. And then we talk to pig farmers in Holland. Like their American counterparts, they're coping with some real problems. These stories and more coming up on the Environment Show. National wildlife refuges across the country have been trying to find a way to get rid of purple loosestrife. That's the beautiful tall weed which has been in the country for years, but since the 80s, many refuges have been overrun by it. Ecologists say loosestrife crowds out indigenous plants, and it also infringes on the habitat for animals. So following the lead of other refuges, the Montezuma Wildlife Refuge, which is near Seneca Falls, New York, is turning to European insects to control that sea of purple which is growing in its wetlands. From WRVO in Oswego, New York, Eugene Son reports that after some small-scale experiments, 50,000 of the insects have been released there this summer.
Purple loosestrife isn't just another weed brought in from overseas. It has taken over much of the Montezuma Refuge, to the point that it controls what can and can't be done there. Outdoor recreation planner for the refuge, Marva Gingrich, says the staff's hands are tied.
There are a lot of things that we could do management-wise to improve the quality of the ecosystem as far as for what's best for wildlife, but we're limited because of purple loosestrife. We can't draw water levels down during the summer months because we'll expose a whole layer of mud flats that'll just grow into loosestrife. We can't provide early season shorebird habitat because of the same thing. Loosestrife will grow and thrive.
And in the places where loosestrife already dominates, birds and animals are having a hard time finding the plants they depend on.
Black terns are an inland freshwater marsh nesting bird that depends on the old, broken down, decaying material from cattail from a previous year's growth to build a floating nest. With purple loosestrife, you don't have that. If you drive around and look, you'll see the nice new green stuff with the purple flowers. But out in the water, you'll also see that it's grown up under, through and under and around these woody stalks. It's a lot like a woody plant, so it doesn't provide that decaying layer of material for those birds to use.
So Gingrich and the rest of the staff sought the help of Cornell University professor Bart Blossi. The German-born ecologist is an expert on using insects to control the weed. He helped select several bugs which have worked well at devouring loosestrife without harming other plants. Blossi says they brought in 5 insects. Some attack the leaves, some the roots, and others the flower of the plant. He says the insects are so specialized that if the loosestrife runs out and the bugs cannot migrate to another area, they will die off, thus not posing a threat to indigenous plants. Near the refuge's visitor center, Blossi points to 2 12-foot square areas, which have been caged off and covered with bug netting. Last summer, the insects were released into one cage, the experimental, and none were released into the other, the control.
After 1 year of feeding, you can see a quite dramatic effect. A couple of, maybe even a week ago, there was no plant flowering in the experimental cage, whereas in the control cage, where there are no insects, all of them were flowering. Now a few started flowering in the experimental cage.
Blossi says the insects do a better job at getting rid of loosestrife than herbicides, mowing, or even flooding out the area. All those methods wipe out other plants in the process. He says the extremely selective insects are also more cost-effective in the long run. While the first year's expense is higher, the bugs will not need to be re-released each year, bringing savings in the future. While the cage experiment has been deemed a success, the large-scale release won't show results until next spring, because the insects eat the most when they're first born.
So at this time of the year, we can look hard and we will probably find maybe 1 or 2 if we look very hard. They're sitting in the leaf litter waiting for spring, even though it's 85 and a wonderful day out here right now. So in the spring, as soon as loosestrife starts growing, they will come out of the leaf litter and start feeding, mating, and ovipositing. And then probably in late May and June, we will see the dramatic effect by the larvae defoliating the plants. The larvae then themselves will move into the soil, pupate, come up as new adults, feed a little bit, and restart the overwintering process.
The refuge worked out a deal with Blossi and Cornell so it doesn't have to pay for the insects in return for giving Blossi and his students a site for their experiments. Another refuge in Oregon was so successful with the insects that it packed them up to be sent elsewhere. While he hopes to breed enough insects to export to other areas, Blasi says loosestrife is so well established at Montezuma that it won't ever be eliminated. He says if the bugs do their job, the purple weed will merely dot the landscape instead of cover it. For the Environment Show, I'm Eugene Sawn.
We're Talking Green, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. Today we're talking about managing spent nuclear fuel on an international basis, which raises some questions in my mind since I don't think we're doing very well on a national basis. But in any event, our conversation is occasioned by the first international convention on managing spent nuclear fuel, which recently concluded in Vienna, and 88 nations, including our own, signed a protocol which is supposed to govern how nuclear fuel is to be gotten rid of, or at least managed. We want to hear from you. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. I have two guests with me today. Mary Olson is the nuclear waste specialist with the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, a nonprofit group based in Washington, D.C., and Dale Klein, and he's the associate vice chancellor for the University of Texas System, and he is a scholar and has a Ph.D. in nuclear engineering and a research center located in Amarillo, Texas. So, Dale, let me start with you. An international convention to deal with spent nuclear fuel. Is this worth anything more than the paper it's printed on? Does anybody pay any attention to this kind of thing?
Well, it really does, Peter, and I think what was really good about this convention is that it is starting the process to bring a lot of the nuclear materials under the sort of the purview of the International Atomic Energy Agency. And so what this convention really dealt with is trying to get all the countries to come up to some agreed-upon standards of how to store spent nuclear fuel and other activities. And this was primarily directed towards the civilian programs, not the defense and military installations.
Well, and that's a question that I wanted to ask you about. Mary Olson from Nuclear Waste or Nuclear Information and Resource Service, if the military stuff is excluded from this, how effective is it going to be?
Well, quite frankly, the vast majority of radioactivity that's resulted in the last 50 years has been from the production of electricity through nuclear power around the planet. About 95% of the total radioactivity is in, I don't call it spent fuel, Peter. I call it irradiated fuel because there's nothing spent about it but how expensive it is to keep track of it. It's highly, highly radioactive material, the most concentrated radioactive material on the planet. And so, in fact, I think that for an international accord to focus on it is appropriate. However, radiation is radiation, and it doesn't matter whether it's civilian or military. People who are affected by it are need protection. So I think that there is a false split there.
Now, the convention itself talks about safety and management and that kind of thing. As we look across the world, we look at the tremendous problems that seem to be occurring in Russia and other places we maybe don't even know about. What impact is an international convention going to have on any of these people, including ourselves, since we can't even figure out where we're going to put our stuff? Dale, what do you think?
Well, I think, Peter, what this convention dealt with was basically looking at a lot of the countries to, again, bring them up to what I would call reasonable expectations for storage of the materials. In other words, this does not deal with the ultimate disposition. This is basically the storage of spent fuel and some of the programs that deal with it. For example, worker protection, emergency preparedness. It also deals with sealed sources that are also used in the medical profession. And so what this really does, Peter, is, for example, you look at some of the countries that participated in this convention. It includes things like India, Iraq, Pakistan, Libya, Russia, Syria, China, as well as, you know, the Western European countries that have well-established programs like France, Britain, Germany. And what it really did was bring these programs up to an acceptable level of standards, and they're primarily adopting a lot of the practices that the United States commercial industry already has because they have done an excellent job of storing these materials in a safe and an environmentally sound manner.
And that's what they're really trying to do, Peter, is look at this in a global situation, because the nuclear is a worldwide issue. It's not just a United States issue. It's not just a Russian issue. It's a world issue. And a lot of countries have these materials, and it was to establish acceptable standards for storage and monitoring of the spent fuel. Again, it does not deal with the permanent disposition. It's only the temporary storage.
And yet storage and monitoring is pretty much the whole deal, since that may go on for decades until people can figure out what else to do, I assume.
That's absolutely correct.
I think we need to clarify, however, that this convention does do something more than that. I think, you know, 50 years into the nuclear age, it's extremely important that we're doing things like making an inventory of what wastes are where and placing responsibility for the existing wastes. But this convention does two other things. First, it encourages a continued production of the material and continued reprocessing, separation of plutonium of the material, which our government has historically had an opposition to. And secondly, and I think more importantly, it opens the doorway to an international shell game, allowing the transboundary shipment of irradiated fuel, nuclear fuel, from one country to another for either storage or disposal. And this is basically paving the way for an era that has not yet begun of, indeed, the global impacts of wealthier nations not accepting waste disposal in their own countries. And although the convention says that the idea is that everybody keeps their own, this convention sets up the mechanisms for export and export to other countries without having any real criteria for what is acceptable in terms of environmental standards, environmental justice standards, anything that you could call more than a business deal.
That raises a really interesting issue.
Out.
Because one of the things that was happening in this country before the clamps got put down is plain ordinary chemical waste, toxic waste, was being shipped abroad to places that could stash it in the ground someplace and get away with it.
That's
Dale,
right.
Do you think that this convention will encourage that kind of activity with respect to nuclear waste?
Not at all. I think this, if you read the documents and the acts that came out of that convention, it basically dealt with what are the safety issues, how should we go around and develop the practices and procedures so that it's done in a safe and environmentally sound manner. I think one could always speculate and play what-if games, you know, in terms of what might happen and things of that nature. But I don't believe that this convention itself will encourage or discourage things like reprocessing or other kinds of shipments. Those will be determined on a case-by-case basis with the countries that are already involved.
Well,
so
let me ask you something about the way this thing gets implemented. After it gets signed and all that stuff, they've agreed to it, but the formal procedure requirements haven't been finished. But assuming that will happen, this comes under the aegis of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Is there any mechanism by which there are any teeth to see that any of these standards are actually adhered to after people sign it?
My perception, based on what we have seen in countries like North Korea, Iraq, and others, even those who have signed the non-proliferation aspects, it really takes a lot of additional pressure by other countries to enforce any agreements. I think this is a first step to at least have the countries to agree upon what are the standards. Once you agree upon the standards, then I think your comments are very appropriately put. Generally, the IAEA does not have a lot of enforcement capabilities. It's only the pressures that other countries will put on them. For example, the North Korea situation of storing their spent fuel in corrosive conditions, it was definitely an environmental concern. But the IAEA did not have the authority to do anything about it. In fact, North Korea kicked them out. So I think you bring up a very valid point that there does have to be a consensus later on of what do you do with people who don't agree to these standards. But I think this was a good first step of coming up with what are minimum acceptable standards.
One of the great things about talking on the radio is you can speculate about all kinds of things and probably don't have to do much. But I'm interested, Mary, in your views as to what the next step ought to be if one really needs to put teeth in some of these things so that one could ultimately ensure better storage and clamp down on the whole proliferation of the nuclear waste problem?
Well, I think that the thing that would start giving teeth to this agreement right here is to extend the protections to all nations, whether they are party signers or not. The next thing we need, in brief, is for the World Court to go ahead and implement a program that was decided on at Rio with the Summit on the Environment, which is to have an environmental court of the world that anyone can bring a case to when there's a problem, whether it be an organization or a country. Currently, our World Court only allows cases from nation states. But in the situation of something that's affecting the whole world, and I agree, this is an issue that is global. We have to treat it that way.
So,
but we need to treat it where people who are affected get the rights to be the teeth.
Going a step further, thinking about the World Court notion where anybody could go.
Yeah.
I live in Utah. I don't believe in establishing a permanent facility. Should I be able to go to the World Court and say, keep it out of my state?
Well, I think that we need to be urging that permanent facilities are met, are only established with the highest standards based on science that is credible. And right now in the United States, our high-level waste program is pretty clearly being driven by politics, and the science is not supporting the political decisions, and yet we're not canceling Yucca Mountain. We're not vetoing a decision to try and put waste on an Indian land in Utah simply because it's a tribe that says they'll take it, not because the site has been shown to be scientifically a good place for the waste to go.
Let's step back a moment. Given a world in which apparently from civilian power production we're accumulating nuclear waste all over the place, Dale, does it make sense to assume that the most efficient thing is for each country to work itself out of this problem on its own, or should there be a broader international effort than merely setting standards, as you point out, is a necessary first step as a result of the convention?
Well, I think, Peter, it would be good if the whole world would get together, for example, on the issue of spent fuel disposal, and come up with agreed-upon standards. And I agree with Mary that I think all countries should somehow participate in that, but you have to realize that certain countries have more involvement and more at stake just because they have more of their energy supply from nuclear. For example, France gets about 75% of their electricity from nuclear. And while people in Germany might disagree with that, France has its own sovereign rights and is going to do what it needs to do in its best interest. But when you look at, for example, the storage and disposal of spent fuel, if a country only has one small reactor, it doesn't really make a lot of technical sense for that country to go through a lot of expense to develop a site in their own country, particularly if they don't happen to have the right geological and scientific conditions. I disagree with Mary in terms of, while I can't say that our spent fuel program has been exactly had a stellar record, there is a lot of scientific input that comes into it. Ultimately, the decision is going to be policy-based, just like it's going to be in any countries. If you take something to the World Court, that's a policy decision. That's not a technical decision. So we have to strike a balance between technology and policy in all of these issues. But I would like to see, Peter, the world get together and come up with an agreed-upon system for the ultimate disposition of the spent fuel. The storage of the spent fuel is one in which the United States has an excellent record of doing it safely and environmentally sound and worker protection.
Okay.
Other countries don't have the same characters.
I'm afraid our time is up. And I think when it comes to dealing with spent nuclear fuel, there are lots of ideas out there, and they will probably be batted around as long as the problem exists, which I guess is in the terms of hundreds of thousands of years. I want to thank our guests. We've been joined by Mary Olson, who is with the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, and with Dale Klein, who is Vice Chancellor of the University of Texas System. We've been talking green on the Environment Show about international management of nuclear waste. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN, and I'm your host, Peter Burley.
Raising pigs presents environmental problems everywhere. Earlier, we looked at water pollution from pig farms in the Midwest. Lauren Comito reports from Holland that the Dutch also are struggling with the impact of big pig farms. There are 15 million pigs in the Netherlands, and a lot of pork is exported. In fact, the Dutch eat twice as much pork as they do beef or chicken. But when swine fever broke out on pig farms earlier this year, everyone started thinking about how pork makes it to the table.
The signs on the highways are hard to miss. Yellow with big black letters warning swine fever, pig transport forbidden. That's only one of the measures taken since swine fever was discovered last February on farms in the south. In an attempt to stop the spread of the disease, 10% of pig farms here, about 2,000, have been taken out of production. One-third of the country's pigs have already been slaughtered, and the European Union has banned the export of live Dutch pigs, all of which make it very difficult for pig farmers, like Benny Van Tala, to do their jobs.
I'm as a fattening pig farmer. I'm not allowed to transport any pigs, so I have and keep them on my barn. So they're still growing and growing bigger. So my shed will be too small for these big pigs at the moment, and that's the problem. Especially when you see at the moment the hot weather makes it not very easy to keep them very comfortable in your sheds.
Van Tala has been farming pigs for almost 20 years on the farm his grandfather started. He lives in the east of the country, just 7 kilometers from the site of the latest case of swine fever. Because of that, he has effectively been shut down until authorities are convinced the disease, which is highly contagious, has been contained. Van Tala says it's costing him about 10,000 guilders a week, roughly $5,000. That's a price he never expected to pay. Until last month, swine fever had been confined to the south.
That was a really surprise because the time being from February to July is a very long time, and if you see that it's not coming, you say you every time and every day you think no, it don't will come, but at the end it still did come.
And because it did, a controversial proposal to drastically overhaul pig farming by Agriculture Minister Josias van Aartsen may now have more support.
We moeten inkrimpen in de komende jaren. Niet als doel op zich, maar om een werkelijk gezondere en sterke...
Minister Van Aartsen wants to see a 25% reduction in the number of pigs by next year. The proposal he'll submit to Parliament will also force farmers to obey stricter environmental and animal welfare codes. Van Aartsen says a smaller but better pig sector is the only hope for the future of the industry, a claim that has farmers and their lobbying groups outraged.
This is a disaster, and we are totally opposed to such a policy. We would ask the minister to withdraw this proposal and to think with us together with us, if other proposals, if other policy could not achieve the same goals as he wants to achieve with his policy.
Rob Tazelaar is president of the Meat and Livestock Board. He agrees that something needs to be done, but he wants to see a smaller decrease in the number of pigs over a longer period of time. Fearing that over half of the Netherlands' 20,000 pig farms would go out of business if Van Aartsen gets his way, Tazelaar says the minister is playing politics, taking advantage of public sentiment to pass his own draconian measures.
I can't see that some of the people in Holland are just fed up with the whole production of pigs in Holland. The production in Holland of pigs is very intensive. It's more intensive than in other places in Europe. They do forget that the actual pork production, pig production if you want, causes labor for so many people in this country. And the total of 80,000, 90,000 people are working in this industry.
That's the sound of pigs on their way to being electrocuted. It's an image broadcast regularly here on TV, and it's one that may help explain the public's lack of sympathy for pig farmers. That and the other images of life on a pig farm. The animals are crowded into small spaces, which many say has helped spread the disease. They spend their short lives in windowless pens. Their food intake is regulated by computer until they are ready for slaughter. Jerome Remmers is with the Netherlands Society for Nature and the Environment.
There are too many pigs in Holland, everybody knows it. 75% of all the pigs from Holland, they are for the export, and this generates a lot of money, that's true. But at the other side, there are a lot of subsidies for the pig industries. So this costs also money for the society, and there are a lot of environmental costs. So then it gives another picture about if it's really so good for the Dutch economy.
The Agriculture Ministry estimates that the epidemic has already cost over 1 billion guilders, or $500 million, and economic forecasts say the final loss could be twice that. The European Union and Dutch government, or taxpayers, will foot most of the bill, adding to public perceptions that the farmers are getting off relatively lightly. But people are still purchasing their pork. Swine fever is not transmittable to humans, so the only factor leading people to temporarily curb their pork buying was a price increase following the slaughter of so many pigs. But prices are down again, and people are buying.
I'm just buying some of this. It's for friends of mine. I think it's a pity that they've let it go on this far. They should have done something about this probably a long time ago. I think it's a shame to see animals so closely together. And I think I don't care. I'll pay more money for my meat, providing the animals are treated a little better. That's my point of view.
When it's destroyed, this disease, I think it's still good to eat pork.
Are you still buying pork now?
Yes, I do.
I think the pork you buy in the store is okay.
It could take over a year for the industry to rebound. That may seem like a long time, but this issue has been publicly debated for the past 10 years. In its latest chapter, farming representatives met earlier this week with Agriculture Minister Van Artsen. They offered him their own proposal to restructure the industry. But it didn't go far enough, said the minister, and he sent them back to the drawing board.
That was Lauren Comito reporting from the Netherlands. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. You can't grow pigs without a cassette copy of the program, so call 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 403. The Environment Show is produced by National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Chartok is the executive producer, and producers are Rachel Phillips and Stephen Westcott. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Caput Fund, the Packard Foundation, the Oliver and Jeannie Donaldson Charitable Trust, Bob and Marilyn Schumann, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.